Mr. Shusnarina Rapslita. I acknowledge my thanks to David Levy, who has shown me the new North Hendon Adas cookery book, which shows a recipe for a honey turkey roll, and the illustration next to it is a selection of cheeses. So we obviously need to discuss the subject of kashrut, but before we do, today is an interesting day in the calendar, because although we said Tachanun this morning, today is the first day after Chanukah. Yesterday was called Zos Chanukah, and the Anshei Kabbalah and the Hasidim attach great importance to the fact that Chanukah is really the grand finale of the period of the Yomim Meroim, and that the final Teshuvah can be done with Chanukah for the start of the year. So much so that the gematria of Zos Chanukah is the same as the gematria for Gemar Chasimo. So yesterday we had this grand finale, we cleansed of our sins, and today is our first day of the new calendar with a clean slate, starting afresh. So what better subject is there to talk about than Kashrus? And in fact, when we're talking about Chanukah, just one idea which we can carry with us, the question is asked by the Pnei Yeshua, why was there such a fuss about the Pach Shemen, about the bit of oil, when really, l'halocha, tumah hutra b'tzibur, we could have used tomei oil in the event that no pure tohar oil was available. However, it was the feeling that we should still do what we can to use what is tohar. And the Beis HaLevi says that the whole reason why we have the mitzvah of Mahadrin and Mahadrin and Mahadrin by Chanukah, more than in any other mitzvah where we stress the idea of Hidur, is because the whole Nes happened because of Hidur. The whole miracle happened because of Hidur mitzvah. That they said that we're still dafka going to use whatever we've got, which is tar, and we're not going to make a thinner wick where the oil could burn for longer, but we will do it the same as normal, and it was because of the Hidur mitzvah that the Nes happened. And therefore, when we now come into the subject of kashrus, we can find also that if people are machmir on something, it's not because they're doing it for the sake of chumras per se, but it's because they want to be 100% sure that they're not coming anywhere near to an issur. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about this morning is, as it's called, practical kashrus. I'm going to start off talking a bit about my own life story, but if I do talk too long about myself, do start coughing, because it can sound like one is being a bit of a bore when one talks about oneself. But when I was a schoolboy in the 1960s, I had the distinguished honour also of being the shamus of this shul. It was traditionally given to a schoolboy, and from the time I was the mitzvah till I was 18, I was shamus of the shul. And this beautiful building was opened in the year 1967, and in the course of tidying up, the foundation stone was laid in 65, but it was actually opened in 67. I've still got the brochure, actually. Anyway, and in the course of tidying up, I often came across sweet wrappers from makes which were known not to be kosher. There had been, in the early 1960s, what was called the Gateshead List, where publication was made from somebody in Gateshead of the non-Jewish confectionery which could be eaten, where details had been verified and there had been a list, but that list had suddenly stopped. And at that time, when I saw that there was a certain particular make of confectionery which was being consumed, which was known not to be kosher, I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll make a little notice and stick it on the cloakroom door, and that people should know that it's not kosher. And it didn't occur to me that maybe I should ask permission first. You know, I thought my job was to perhaps do this sort of thing, and I just wrote a little notice to say that this food was not kosher. And Rabbi Cooper Schlita came into the building and saw this notice and said, "Who put that up there?" And proudly I said, "Well, I did." He said, "Well, could you take it down, please?" And I was very surprised. I said, "Well, what do you mean? I mean, I've seen these wrappers constantly in the shul, and surely wouldn't it be right that people are informed?" He said, "Yes, you're quite right. People should not eat non-kosher food. But this is not the way we should set about it." And when I questioned him, he said, look, you'll understand more when you're older. When you're 5 years' time, he said, you'll understand what I mean. And what his reasoning was this. He felt that there is a principle of mutav shiyoshevin v'lo mezidin. Sometimes it's better that people are doing things inadvertently, the shogeg, rather than on purpose, because when people do not appreciate the importance and significance of an issur, then when they're told about it, they might still carry on doing it. They might still say, when it comes to kashrus as well, we've always done it, so it must be all right, or so-and-so does it, or, well, it's batel b'shishim, and all these excuses which people try to find. And he was worried that as a result of that, people would do it for mazes. However, what came out of this was a lot of discussion I had with him, and it was always a great pleasure to grow up under such a great Rav, a Rav who was described by Rabbi Avraham Gurewitz as one of the top five Rabbonim in Europe. And together we thought it might be a good idea if we devise a list. And that way, when you're devising a list, those who are interested will read it, those who are not interested will not read it. Since especially that the gates of list had dried up, we thought that it might be a good idea that we compile a list. So we wrote letters to lots and lots of manufacturers, and in those days you didn't get so many kosher things like you get now. And so we wrote lots and lots of these letters, and we did it through him as part of the school, of the Hasmonean school, because then it gave it more chashivas, more importance. And the headmaster actually remarked to me that I was getting more mail in the post than he was. And we put together the list, as it were, where manufacturers wrote back saying the following products do not contain any ingredients from animal sources, etc. And feeling very proud of ourselves, and there was a lot of work involved in editing it and putting it together. But as we were drafting it, and as our proof copy had come out, and we had already, in fact, printed some 400 or 500 copies of this list, there were certain things which came to light which we had not been aware of. Number one, the word ingredient does not include certain things which go into a manufactured product. For example, emulsifiers. Emulsifiers are certain, they might be kosher, they might not be kosher, but they are added to combine, let's say, oily, watery substances to create a blend, to put it simply. And we also found that manufacturers are constantly changing their ingredients. So if you tell people something's kosher, then since they're constantly under review, then people might not be aware that from the time they get their list till a later period of time, these ingredients may have changed. At that time, we had discovered that there was one firm in America which was kashering its machines once a year, and for a whole week was manufacturing kosher emulsifier, and manufacturing it to the extent that it was exporting it to all the kosher firms in the world. And now various other problems which had come up. For example, when you come across the word glycerine or glycerol, which is now known as E422, it might be made from vegetarian sources, but it might be made from animal sources. Colorings. Sometimes you see on the ingredients the word colorings and natural flavorings. Colorings can include the beetle insect cochineal, which is E120 nowadays. Natural flavorings. I've got an article here where a rabbi in America shows how natural flavorings can include civet, which is an Ethiopian cat, musk, which comes from an ox, castoreum, which comes from the beaver, ambergris, which comes from whales, and pepsin, which is the digestive juice derived from pigs and cows. And that is an ingredient frequently found in chewing gum. So what happened when we discovered all this, and we had the benefit at that time of a member of this shul, Mr. Steinhardt, who was a co-owner of Snow Test Ice Cream, and with his assistance we found out a lot of these things. And so what did we do? Rabbi Cooper said to me, throw the whole lot away. And with a heavy heart, all that work was put into the dustbin. It is interesting that nowadays we do have certain kosher lists, and perhaps the most well-known one is the Really Jewish Food Guide from the London-based DIN. And we have to appreciate that what work is going into this under Rabbi Conway, under the London-based DIN, in order to try and help people avoid eating non-kosher foods. And in fact there is a page 28 I'm looking at, where it talks about the problematic E-numbers, and it gives a few dozen of those. And it lists this E120 cochineal and glycerol E42 and emulsifiers and stabilizers E432, 495, 1441 from fatty acids. Stabilizers help to keep the product in a stable condition and they might cause problems. There's E542, edible bone phosphate, degreased steam extract of animal bones, used in medicines. Stearic acid, E570, naturally occurring fatty acids found in all animal fats and vegetable oils, used as an anti-caking agent. E572, magnesium stearate, prepared synthetically from commercial stearic acid, used as an anti-caking agent, and so on and so forth. Now, we therefore have to appreciate that we have such lists, which list NK for not kosher, P for Parav, and then there's M for milky if it's not Chol of Yisrael. And it's interesting to note that we do get changes from time to time. So without wishing to criticise in any way such a worthwhile publication, after all it's the London-based thing whom we rely on for Gittin and for Kashrus and certain other things which we won't go into now, but when you look at the website of the United Synagogue, and I've got printed off the updates, you do benefit from latest Kashrus updates and alerts. So I printed this off just a few days ago, and it gives dates when these updates are made. Monday the 14th of December, so that's just last week. Twinings Winter Spice Infusion contains natural wine flavouring and is therefore not kosher. So in the 2009 Jewish Food Guide, this item is regarded as kosher, and now it's discovered that this Winter Spice Infusion contains natural wine flavouring. Wine, Stam Yenom, from non-Jewish source, is not kosher. All other Twinings tea are permitted. And then there are some other updates. 24th of September 2009, Smirnoff Blueberry Twist, listed on page 111 as approved and parov, has changed formulation and is now not kosher. Just to pick on one or two more examples, Patterson Oat Cakes, listed on page 46, are no longer KLBD certified or kosher approved. Old stock bearing the KLBD logo is still permitted. 24th of June 2009, due to a change in formulation, Super Sweet Mini Sweeteners, listed on page 98 of the Really Jewish Food Guide 2009 as approved and parov, are now not kosher. So Super Sweet Mini Sweeteners, which are in fact on the cover listed when you get a little copy of an extract from this food guide, at the bit of the bottom it says Super Sweet, and near the very bottom it says P Mini Sweeteners, is now, we're told, not kosher. 12th of May 09, McCoy Salt and Malt Vinegar Crisp, listed on page 48 as approved and parov, is now not kosher. 30th of April, Walker Salt and Vinegar Crisp, listed on page 48, approved and parov, is now dairy. So you're not going to, of course, have it with milk. And Cobra, listed, is now no longer certified, not kosher approved, and so on and so forth. And Nestle, the following products, now comes the good news, the other way around. As of January 2009, Nestle, the following products will no longer contain carminic acid E120 and are approved kosher dairy, okay, but that's not Chol of Yisrael. You're advised to check the ingredients, and it says Mini Smarties and Smarties are now kosher with the M label. So before Smarties were not kosher, now they are. Alright, those who used to have Smarties, great. It's not Chol of Yisrael, it's correct to avoid it, but there it is, it's now told that it is now kosher. What we don't know is that in the 2010 copy it will say not kosher, and then who knows, it might change again. So the problem is this, and I think the London-based thing will accept this obviously, that they can't keep tab every single day from one day to the next, because there's a constant review going on as to the ingredients. And in fact, if you go on other websites,
because the Muslim websites and the vegetarian websites also do research about these products and what they contain and whether they're okay. And it is very interesting reading. I thought, out of interest, I'll go into this Muslim website just to see what they are certifying, and they're calling halal what they call kosher. And they do research on things like wool's ice cream and so on. But in order to go into this website, I had to register, and it asked me a basic question about Islam, which I didn't know the answer to. It said, how many pillars are there in Islam? I didn't know, so I googled pillars in Islam, and I found it was the number 5. And and they produce stuff, say, from Wall's Ice Cream, and then you've got people blogging in, people giving their comments. And one of them says, well, I've written to Wall's Ice Cream, and they've written in their letter, we reserve the right to amend recipes as required. So from one day to the next, you don't know what might be happening. And we have to face the fact that even with the kosher food guides, there is the risk that from the time you've received this 2009 food guide in 2009 until you receive the update, if you bother looking at the updates, because you might not, or you might have an old copy, and in fact this one is a 2007 edition. Some people don't bother buying it each one year by year, and a lot of people don't bother going on the internet to see the updates. A lot of people don't have the internet.
You can get
bulletins on email, that is very true. But even then, in between the time that that ingredient has already changed, it's not that those firms will be writing to say in advance, we will be changing as of February 2010, we will be changing the ingredients to such and such. It's not in their marketing interests to do so. So what's happening is, we have already changed those ingredients. Till the time that you find out, you or your children may have been eating chaza treif, point blank, as blunt as that. And that can be very worrying.
The problem is, even if you go over to the American style system where companies are putting like OUs and Circle K's and things on their product, you still, if you look on the OU website or sign up for their information, every week you're getting, oh, this says an OU, but by mistake they put, but it should have an OUD on it. Company X, are you putting an OU on their product? And they shouldn't be. You still get similar sorts of problems. But
it's true, there are problems, and I've got some printouts from the OU and OK websites, where a Rabbi Beryl Levy writes, in the last 6 years I've personally visited over 1,000 factories, and each time, each visit I make to a factory, I learn something new about the complexity of food processing as it relates to the problem of kashrus. And he talks about a visit to a factory in Poland, Portland, Maine is another one, where they process vegetable gum, often known as carrageen. I remember my grandmother, Zichron Levracha, used to drink carrageen tea, which is a seaweed, it's a herb, perfectly kosher. It seems perfectly harmless. But what they do to it is that in order to dry it into a powder, they either spray it or they drum dry it. And when it's drum dried, it will normally stick to the pot in which it's being dried. So to prevent this, it's cooked with an emulsifier. Emulsifiers can be made either from vegetable or animal source. So it needs rabbinical supervision. So when you see the word vegetable gum, or Irish moss as it's sometimes called, or carrageen, it's not necessarily an innocent vegetable product. There are other problems. He says there are 445 kosher supervising agencies in the world. However, some of them are not necessarily top recommended. Claiming something is kosher or not kosher is no longer a matter of just being God-fearing or knowing Yeradeah. A very big part of Hashkocha is knowledge of technology and machinery. We have numerous experiences of our staff going into a plant where another agency, sometimes very sincere people, is supervising a special kosher run, but we were able to point out very serious problems. For example, some machines have certain non-visible materials, like a ceramic bolt, that cannot be kashered. So Mashgiach really needs to know the makings of the machine and how it works. He says we've got 35,000 formulas in a database. Just because one part of the machine registers 212 degrees, which is really 100 degrees centigrade, boiling point, and it's being kashered, this doesn't mean that there isn't another part that is, in truth, a much lesser temperature. The mashgiach has to know about a working knowledge of steam systems. He says he has a certificate in dryer technology, because lab technicians need to know about the food industry. He's got a University of Wisconsin degree in order to understand this subject, in order to understand kashrus. A spray dryer takes a liquid product, converts it to a powder, the same problem as we discussed. He says since a spray dryer can cost up to several $1 million, a company will spray dry a vast array of different products using a single machine. So many of these products can be dairy or non-kosher. So you need to kasher between the different product runs. So it's not enough just to know the ingredients, but it's need to know whether the machine it was used in was also used for other things. Now I'm not trying to scaremonger you, but sometimes when it comes to flavours, people will say, well, since the action about the flavour is so small, people might argue, well, it's Bottel B'Shishim or Bottel B'Rov, but that doesn't make sense, because the whole reasoning behind the din of Bittel is that the taste is no longer recognisable. Tam Ki'ikah D'Oraisa is the principle. So if something is specially put there because of its taste, it can't be nullified because of the din of Bottel B'Shishim. Well, whether by accident or on purpose. Yeah, the general principle of Bittel, of Taruvos, is when it falls accidentally into something. Yeah, it does fall accidentally into something, and therefore it's called Mishbach, and it will become Bottel of its position. But if something was put in, Lechachila, one mustn't put in something where it says Eilu Batlin Issa Lechachila, but if B'dieved something was put in, even intentionally, if it is less than 60th and it is not there to impart a taste, there are heterin. And at that time Rabbi Cooper was allowing me to include certain things in the list where the manufacturer said they are trace amounts only. He felt we could put it in. I won't say the name of that product, because now when I look at this list, it's not kosher anymore. But at that time, in the 1960s, there was not a problem. So we've got many additives, and they're called natural flavours. And ingredients do not include processing agents, release agents, often of animal origin. Oils, shortening. Sometimes you see the word vegetable oil. One of the things which Rabbi Cooper and I discovered was that when you see the word pure vegetable oil, the word pure only needs to mean 90%. And so there's an even bigger problem when you just see vegetable oils. If you buy a tin of sardines without a hechsher and it says vegetable oil, legally it hasn't got to be only vegetable oil, because it can include animal oils within it. Pure apple cider can be a problem. We don't always know, and it has to be verified. And then of course the subject of grapes, grape juice or wines are not kosher if they are not supervised. And grape juice is a very common ingredient for flavouring purposes. And often you will see just flavourings or fruit juice flavourings. You think, well, fruit juice is all right. And that's put into jam and in soda and popsicles and sweets and fruit punches, lemonades. The list is endless. Baking is another subject of its own, because baking, in this country, it's common for tins to be greased with animal fats. So they'll say they're kosher ingredients, and you might even go into a vegetarian or vegan shop or restaurant, and they'll be selling sandwiches there, and they'll say it's all vegan, and you ask them, well, did you bake the bread yourself? And no, we buy that in. They don't think that bread is a problem to be called vegan. So they buy in the bread, and it's a problem. And there are other problems with vegetarian restaurants, because although you might think a simple salad is harmless, all right, they don't check for insects and infestation. But there are other problems with vegetarian restaurants, and that is they use a lot of cheeses, and not just in their salads, but they use these cheeses in their cooked foods to give a flavouring. And so it's hot stuff, and cheese definitely treif. All gewinas akum is not kosher. Even if it's fully made of kosher ingredients, there is a gezeira for Chazal, since it's always been so common to put non-kosher ingredients into cheese, that one may not eat gewinas akum. And of course we discussed a few weeks ago the subject of bishul akum, and it's a minefield if one is relying on such things. Talking about my own life experiences, I once, not very long ago, did a professional job for a certain caterer, a kosher caterer of renown, a Kedashia kosher caterer. I mean, what else is there besides Kedashia? We're sitting in an Adas Shul. And this Kedashia caterer wanted to show his appreciation for something I had done. So on Erev Shabbos, he brought round to my house a whole concoction of different foods, ready prepared, including meat, including various kinds of fish, vegetables, salads, everything, you name it. He didn't know that my wife, that Shabbos, was with her parents in Manchester because her father was very ill, and I couldn't get away, so I was on my own, and I had all for myself this huge spread of what you'd call a basic kiddush for a big community. Well, some things you might be able to put in the freezer, and you know. But the thing which worried me most of all is that all these trays were standing outside my front door because there was nobody in to answer the door. And there was pure, just meat foods out there. And there is a din, basar shenitz alei min ha'ayin. Food which is unattended, food which is not sealed, may not be eaten if it had been out of sight where a non-Jew could have switched it. And there are these stories. I once heard a story of a fellow on a plane who was about to eat his meaty sandwich and then went off to wash his hands, and he came back and he had this funny feeling about it that he had left it unattended and he decided not to eat it. And the non-Jew next to him said, well, why aren't you eating it? And he said, well, it just occurred to me that there is a rule about unattended meat, and I did leave it unattended. He said, well, to tell you the honest truth, I want to see your reaction, and I switched our sandwiches. Now, I phoned up this caterer. I said to him, listen, you got a Kedashia Hechsher. I'm not going to report you, but you know, you left outside my door meat which was unattended. Oh, he said, it's all right. I drove up to your house and I watched the guy putting it there out on your doorstep. So it's all right. I said, what do you mean it's all right? How long ago did you put it there? Oh, it was about an hour ago, an hour and a half ago. I said, well, in that time it was unattended. The meat was not sealed. I'm going to throw it away. He said, oh, no, don't do that. I said, well, he said, it's Baal Tashchis. No, it's not Baal Tashchis because nobody can eat it now. I threw it away. Apart from the fact that it's not good for diet anyway, but that's not part of my remit today to talk about. We're talking about kashrus. So these things come up day to day and we don't realize that they are kashrus problems. And even if people say, oh well, it's a din d'rabbanan, it's not a din d'oraisa, Chazal were masakeing things, especially in kashrus, that they were ke'ein d'oraisa. For example, chicken and milk. You might say, oh, chicken and milk is a din d'rabbanan. But if you look in Yeredeah, in the Shachan Ataz, it says, osu chizuk ledivrehem ke'inu hein d'oraisa. On those subjects, they made a chizuk to their words as though they are dinim in HaTorah, because kashrus is something, when you start compromising, then your sofek already enters the daraisa. So we don't say sofek drabbanon l'kula, we say sofek drabbanon l'chumra. Because, for example, with gavina sakum, if you would say sofek drabbanon l'kula, where you're in a doubt and you go leniently, although it's a din drabbanon, the whole subject is kashrus, that you might end up eating something kev. So therefore, the din of gavinas akum has a sofek drabbanon lechumra and not lekula. And so it carries on. Another experience of mine I'll mention is we once had a supermarket in Golders Green called Rudge. So I can talk about that without being risk of being sued for libel or slander. And Raj was a non-Jewish owned supermarket who imported many kosher foods, and in fact many kosher foods from abroad which the other kosher shops didn't even stock. And I was in there once just before Pesach, and I saw some chocolates with stickers on them with a Hechsher from Rav Meir Levinger of Basel. And I was a bit puzzled when I looked at this chocolate, because on the ingredients it referred to lecithin. Lecithin is usually kosher, usually from vegetarian sources, and it is though kitnius, and we don't see kitnius on Pesach, and this was a chocolate set aside for Pesach. So I bought a couple of these, and, well, you see, my wife comes from Basel, and I knew Rav Levinger, and I knew that the manager of the shul under Rav Levinger's employment is my brother-in-law and cousin. So I phoned him up and I said, can I check this out with you? I've got this chocolate from Raj and Golders Green which has a Hechsher of Rav Levinger, and I would like to check out if it's genuine. Did Rav Levinger know that there is lecithin in these chocolates? Some of them, they removed the lecithin for Pesach, fair enough. And he checked it out, and Rav Levinger said, I have never given my Hechsher to this firm. They did originally approach me and ask me if I would consider a Hechsher for their firm, but it was never followed up. I've never visited their factory, and I've had nothing to do with them since. I have not given them a Hechsher. And these were just stickers on the bars of chocolate. So, in connection with Rav Levinger, we arranged announcements in a couple of Jewish newspapers. This is to notify that the chocolate from Basel, blah, blah, blah. And he gave a good dressing down to the manufacturer, and a call was made to Raj. However, people had already bought these things, and people don't read these tiny announcements in the Jewish Tribune or Chronicle about this chocolate is not really kosher for Passover. All right, it's not the end of the world, you might say, because lecithin is not chometz gomor, and the Sephardim eat this on Pesach, but there is a lesson to be drawn from this, and that is, even when you see the Hechsher, there might be cause for suspicion to, if there's a problem. And there are lots of scare stories, one can say, and unfortunately there have been problems with even very kosher Hechsherim. There was a big scandal in Monsey a couple of years back about the chickens, which had been going on for a while, and one has to be as careful as possible. Obviously we have to put our trust in the rabbinate whom we follow, and they are doing their best amongst enormous problems to be able to provide us with Hechshered kosher food. But alertness is the name of the game, and once something is factory processed, you're already putting yourself into a risk. The moment a food is no longer natural, and even natural foods, I mean dried fruits, do we know what they're coated with? There can be problems. Even foods which we think are completely natural and not processed, not cooked, there may be problems with them, apart from the infestation which we know about. We might carry on the subject of practical kashrus on another occasion, but just to end off, just to make you feel as though I haven't given you a list of don'ts, I'd like to quote from Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Shemini, which says, Omar Kodesh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to the people of Israel, Kol ma she'osarti lecho, hitarti lecho kenegdo. Don't worry that I'm giving you these isurim on kashrus, because everything that I've forbidden to you, I've also given you something which is allowed. I've forbidden you to eat blood, but I've allowed you the liver, which is full of blood. Okay, you roast it, but it originates with being full of blood. I have forbidden you to eat the pig, but I've allowed you the fish whose name is Shivuta. It is very similar in its taste and its texture to pork. And the list carries on, and things that which are forbidden and the things which are allowed. And Rabbi Grunfeld, the grandfather of our Rav, writes very eloquently in a very beautiful English the various dinim of kashrus in the Jewish dietary laws. And in this conclusion, he explains how the dietary laws are a bridge between the guf and the neshama, the body and the soul. We don't always understand the dinim of kashrus, because the Torah doesn't actually give a reason for the din of kashrus. It's called a chok, but he says it's the unification of the body and the soul. And a person who considers the satisfaction of bodily desires and pleasure as ends in themselves, his physical desires will never be satisfied. But when we're fulfilling a duty and we're combining the moral with the physical satisfaction with our food, then the tzaddik ochal lesova, the tzaddik will then feel satisfied. And he explains on the pasuk, Lo al alechim levado yichi adam, not only on bread alone can man live. There are many meanings of what this means in the fundamental role of knowing what food we can be eating and not what foods we can't be eating. And the word lechem is in fact three times Hashem's name, hence the custom to dip into the bread into salt three times, and melach is also the same, the gematria, which is three times Hashem's name. And that the whole raison d'etre of human existence is to know what our true mission is on the earth, and to combine the body and soul is done with kashrus. The dietary laws have refined Israel's body and ennobled its soul, endangered that spirit of martyrdom and self-sacrifice. And I would like to end off for 2 minutes with a nice little sweet story I came across on the subject of blood spots on eggs. Well, nowadays it's not such a problem as it used to be with factory farms, and we can discuss that another time. but we should be careful that we don't have blood spots in eggs. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to peel off the white of his egg to see if there are any blood spots underneath. And there's a Sefer Torah as our guide, which has a very nice story about once it happened many years ago in northern Poland. There was a Polakoff's Inn where there was a restaurant which was Jewish owned, and a very well-dressed governor came into this inn. He was hungry, he was starving, his coach and horses broke down, and he wanted a meal, and he decided he would like to have an omelette. And eggs were very expensive in those days, and he told the lady that I'd like an omelette. She said, yes, well, you realize it costs a lot of money, eggs, but he said, I don't mind. And she only had 12 eggs left, and she started cracking them in front of him and moving the yolk from one eggshell to another, and he noticed that she was throwing away. She was throwing away these eggs. 7 eggs she opened and then threw away. Until the 8th and 9th egg were okay and she made the omelette. He said, what are you doing? Why are you throwing away all these expensive eggs? She said, because the Torah does not allow us to eat blood. And he said, well, they're just tiny blood spots. She said, it doesn't matter. The Torah will not allow us to eat blood. The smallest amount of blood we wouldn't dream of eating. He said, I'll pay you back. I'll pay you for those broken eggs. She said, no, they are my eggs. You don't have to pay me back for them. Anyway, he had his omelette. He was very happy, and off he went. And 2 years later, he was reading the paper to discover that there was a pogrom in a neighboring village because Jews were being accused of using the blood of Christian children for matzos. And he thought, this can't be. 2 years ago, I went into this Jewish restaurant, this Jewish inn, and I heard what they said about the blood. This just can't be. And he went over to the village where he found a lot of bloodshed going on and a lot of massacre going on. And he went to the mayor. His name was Mayor Krushevetsky. He was a governor called John Stefanski. And he put a stop to it. He said, look, and I can tell you, this is just not true. And he told him the story, and he spoke to the whole village about his experience of this Jewish restaurant, of the woman who would not allow blood spots in her eggs. And that put a stop to the whole blood libel and a stop to any more pogroms in that part of northern Poland. A fascinating subject. We can appreciate that it's the martyrdom of our ancestors which give us the courage to continue and to make sure we keep kashrus 100%. Thank you. No, there is no principle of chazaka. If the ingredients change, there is no chazaka that a non-Jewish ice cream was on a list and now it's got a chazaka. If the ingredients change, it's lost its identity. Yeah, but that's not a chazaka. They were eating trade for the showgate. They were eating meat unintentionally, which was not kosher. There's no such thing as chazaka there. There may be in certain aspects of Hilchas Toloim certain principles of chazaka, but we can't go into that now. But in general, if something is not kosher, it doesn't have a chazaka, then it might be kosher.